in the early days of the discoveries of quantum mechanics, you find new things out. And so in particular, this talk will be about the kinds of questions that you would ask in communication theory. And this will build on some types of questions and answers that were asked and found about 60 years ago by Claude Shannon in trying to analyze mathematically what happens when I communicate through a noisy communication channel. So what did Claude Shannon do? Well, so he said, let's imagine that that a noisy channel is modeled by some set of conditional probabilities here. So here we imagine that x and y are elements of some finite sets, and let's say x is some set of signals that a sender might want to send over like a communication wire, a telegraph wire or something, and y is some set of possible received signals that the receiver could think that the sender had sent. And so this represents some kind of noise where there's maybe some physics going on here. I mean, obviously there's physics, but we say, well, we just don't know what's happening. So let's just assume that we can model things probabilistically. And nonetheless, the surprising thing is that you can actually send information arbitrarily well, that is with an error going to zero. And you can get much more through than you might have thought otherwise. So what Shannon did was he defined the capacity of a channel, so by a channel I'll just mean these conditional probabilities, as the number of bits which could be reliably sent through the channel in the limit of many transmissions, so divided by the number of transmissions. And so by reliable, I mean really that the error has to go to zero as the number of transmissions goes to infinity. And we could even require that this error goes to zero exponentially fast with the number of transmissions, and that's not going to change anything. So that's the question. And the answer is given by what's known as Shannon's capacity formula. And it involves a quantity called the mutual information, which is built out of entropies as follows. So the idea is that if I have two random variables, x and y, I can define their mutual information. It's some measure of the correlations between these random variables, x and y. And you can understand it from this Venn diagram picture. It's given here. Or algebraically, I can take it as it's the sum of the individual entropies minus the joint entropy, where the entropy here is just the expected logarithm, the negative expected logarithm of the probability. And so the entropy is the measure, is some sort of measure of the randomness or the surprise in the random variable, and the mutual information measures how correlated they are. So what Shannon's capacity formula says is that the capacity of this channel, described by P of y given x, is the maximum of this mutual information, where you consider it as a function of input probability distributions to the channel. Right? So if I fix a probability distribution on the input, this gives me a joint distribution on the input and the output. I compute the mutual information, and I maximize this over all possible inputs. And so the way that you go about proving a theorem like this is you essentially give matching lower and upper bounds. So the lower bound is you show that good codes exist for basically any possible error rate. So, or I should say, for any rate less than the capacity, there exist sequences of codes where the error goes to zero exponentially fast. And you also prove an upper bound or a converse part. And essentially, these lower bounds tend to proceed by random coding arguments. So we're not really concerned in the theory of capacities with whether or not you can efficiently send information. It's just whether it's possible in principle. Although it does turn out that at least for certain classes of channels, like Gaussian noise channels, we do have codes nowadays which can get you arbitrarily close to the capacity, or awfully close, and in some cases have provably efficient coding schemes. So what are some properties of Shannon's capacity? Well, first and foremost, it's additive. So what I mean by this is that if I take two channels and I use them in parallel, and I compute the capacity for this pair of channels, that's equal to the sum of the individual capacities of these channels. So operationally, it means that there's no difference between coding on the left and this type of a coding on the right. It doesn't help you, basically, to use them together. I could break my message into two parts, send one part over the channel N1, send another part over the channel N2, and this will be just the same as kind of trying to cleverly use them together in this way. So, philosophically, what this means is that the capacity is some sort of an intrinsic measure of the value of the channel, which is independent of whatever other types of channels you might have available at your disposal. Or if I want to sell you access to some noisy channel, I can price it based on this capacity here, and I don't have to ask what else you have. I don't have to try to figure out if I can get some more money out of you for it. So what else does it tell us? Well, it tells us that there's a very easy classification of channels that are useless. So basically, this is the only way possible to make a zero capacity channel. You just cut a wire, okay? And essentially, if the capacity is zero, then that means that these conditional probabilities, y, are independent of x. And this basically comes about from the fact that the mutual information between x and y is zero, if and only if x and y are completely uncorrelated. So there's nothing really, really interesting to be said about zero capacity channels. But this talks about quantum channels. So when I say quantum channel, I mean what Jonathan said this morning about what he called a general operation. So these are linear, completely positive, trace-preserving maps on density matrices, or from density matrices on some input Hilbert space A to some output Hilbert space B. So maybe one slight difference is that some people like to think of these as acting on a physical system, but I like to think of them as from one physical system to another, right? This might be, you know, Alice's laboratory. She prepares some state at the input to a fiber optic cable, travels some distance, ends up in Bob's lab, and maybe his Hilbert space is different, right? But nonetheless, you can model them in this way. And so you should really just think of this as physically, it's just some process that's adding noise to a quantum state of a quantum system. And so there's one nice representation theorem, which is kind of going to be, it's just essential for thinking about these capacity results, and that's that a quantum channel can be represented as a reversible interaction or mapping from the input Hilbert space into the tensor product of an output and some inaccessible environment system, E. And the idea is that once it interacts with E, nobody can ever access this information anymore. And so it's getting struck by lightning here. And again, let me mention that we can define the classical capacity of a channel in a similar way as in the classical case, except now that the sender is preparing, say, pure states, and the receiver is performing some quantum measurement. And what we find is that we get the same trivial classification of zero classical capacity channels. And in particular, if I use two channels together that have zero capacity, they're still going to have zero capacity, because two things that are uncorrelated, if you put them together, they're still uncorrelated. So what is the quantum capacity of a channel, though? So this is a slightly different concept, but in another way, it's very similar. It's the same type of question that Shannon asked, but just in a different setting. And because we have quantum channels, we even get to ask this question. So namely, we can define the quantum channel capacity in a number of different ways. One way is as the number of qubits that can be reliably sent through many instances of a channel or many communication settings where each one's modeled by noise given by this channel. And again, it's you know, reliably means that the error goes to zero with the number of transmissions. And this really means how many qubits can you send per transmission as you average over many times. So by sending qubits, what I mean is that there's some physical system in, say, Alice's laboratory. She gets these qubits all in these different states, and maybe somebody else hands them to her and says, you know, will you please encode these into the inputs of the channels by some other physical map. This is another channel or a quantum operation. They go through, they get noisy, and then at the end, the decoder has to apply some other mapping to put these back into, say this is another collection of qubits here, and it should look like this was an identity channel, like they were just given without error. So yet another way that you can define the quantum capacity is rather than asking Alice to send some pre-existing information, you can ask that she just generate pure entanglement in the form of, say, EPR pairs, or what I'll call EBITs, entangled bits, through the channel. So here she would have some states here in her lab, maybe they're sitting over here. She entangles them with the inputs to the channels, That gets transferred through the channels, and then Bob does some decoding map, and then it should look like in between these two terminals they have a bunch of EPR pairs that they're sharing. And it turns out that these two questions have the same answer, and it's actually not too hard to show this. And we can say with some amount of confidence that the quantum capacity, it characterizes the information conveying properties of this channel, right? I mean, you've got these two different questions, and there's a number of others that we can ask that all wind up having the same answer. And we can really think of these as bounds on the ability to perform quantum error correction under a certain type of noise modeled by these channels here. And in particular, this is for independent noise, but there's some things you can say if there's dependence as well. But, and really this is what this talk is about, is that we do not understand this quantity nearly as well as we understand Shannon's capacity. So just let me just give you some examples. So let's think of two different kinds of channels that act on a qubit. The first, I'll call this a qubit flip channel. And this is a channel which, with probability 1 minus p, does nothing, the identity channel. And with probability p, it flips the qubit along the z basis. And what that does is you can envision this acting on the block sphere, where it just squashes the block sphere down like this. So in particular, if you wanted to send classical data through this channel, we just prepare these two states and they would go through without error. Robin?
Benjamin, should that actually be X row X?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. So this really is a bit flip, not a base flip channel.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and then the quantum capacity of this channel is given by 1 minus the binary entropy of P, or the entropy of a coin with probability of heads equal to P. But then, so this one we completely understand this channel. But here's another slightly more relevant channel, even the depolarizing channel. And here, what happens is with probability p, you get replaced by the maximally mixed qubit. So it's sometimes a worse noise than this one here. And what it does is it just maps the block sphere, it shrinks it like this. So we don't understand this channel really at all. And essentially, here's the state of the art of what we know is that the capacity is greater than zero as long as this p is less than some p star, which is in this range. And this is a pretty wide range. And we'd really like to know this p star exactly. And we have some lower bounds and stuff, but they're not tight. So what about a general formula? So how close are we? What do we have? So namely, there's a random coding lower bound. And this was given by Lloyd, Shor, Devatak, and there's a paper that I'm on, which I think gives a pretty understandable proof. And the idea is to code into random subspaces of the input, and it achieves rates that are equal to the coherent information over the channel. So again, this is sort of analogous to what we have with Shannon's formula, where that was a maximization of the mutual information over input distributions. This is a maximization of the coherent information over input density matrices. And so this coherent information is computed by, I stick in some row A, it goes through the channel, and here's the environment here, and I get some joint state on BE, output in the environment, and I take the difference of these entropies. And if I maximize that over all inputs, I get some number, which is, I'll call this the single letter coherent information bound. Some people call this the hashing bound. And it turns out that this lower bound is tight for degradable channels. That's actually why we know the capacity of this qubit flip channel, because it turns out that channel is degradable. And I'll tell you what degradable is in a few slides. It basically just means that this terminal is more powerful than this one. But what's the best that we can currently prove? Well, it's really nothing. We can write down a formula like this, which looks scary because it is. It's some infinite sequence of exponentially, optimization problems that are getting exponentially harder with K. So it's kind of useful as a formal expression, but as nothing else. And we say that Q is the regularization of this Q1 here. Q1 is this maximization right here. It's the single letter maximization. So you maximize over one copy of the channel, then you do it over two, and you divide by two and three. I mean, it's a trivial thing to prove this, but it's impossible to deal with it. So some properties about the quantum capacity, and really the main topic of this talk is that, so what Graham and I were able to show is that the quantum capacity is not additive in the sense that the Shannon capacity is. And so let me add that it was already known that that this Q1 is not additive. And this was known since the 90s. But what we showed was that this infinite limit is not additive either. And in particular, it's not additive in the worst possible way, or some people say maybe the best possible way, and that there are just pairs of channels, each of which has a zero capacity, such that if I use them together, that I can get a non-zero capacity through. So Charlie Bennett called this grossly non-additive. But this begs the question, should I pay for an access to a zero capacity channel? And if so, how much? So just to look at this picture here, the idea is that, yes, if I use these guys together, if I could do some joint encoding on the inputs and the outputs, that actually can have some benefit, unlike in the classical case. So what's going on here? Well, it turns out that there's a non-trivial thing going on with zero capacity channels, unlike in the classical case. So if the capacity is zero, that does not imply that the input and the output are uncorrelated. So you can have some correlations that they're just useless for actually sending quantum information through a channel. But unfortunately, we don't really even have a complete classification of zero capacity channels. But we do know that they don't form a convex set, which is kind of crazy. Oh, we just learned this in the course of this work. But we do have two important convex subsets of zero capacity channels. One is a class of what I'll call the anti-degradable channels. And the second is a class of channels discovered by the Horodetsky family. And I'll explain these in the next few slides. But each of these classes has zero capacity for a different reason than the other. And in some sense, they're complementary in that they manage to cancel each other out and provide use for the other class. And also, you know, I said this class is not convex, and actually that means that you can get zero capacity channels in between, or non-zero capacity channels in between these by taking convex combinations. So let's talk about this first class of channels, the anti-degradable channels. So these are channels where the environment is able to simulate the input. So any state that the output gets can be produced by acting on the environment in the sense of this, commutative diagram here, that there exists some degrading channel that if I apply it to the environment state, I get the output state. So you can show by a simple no-cloning argument that these channels have to have a zero capacity, because otherwise anything that the output could decode, the environment could too, and then you could clone states. And we learned this morning that that's not possible. So this class is also stable under the tensor product, which means that the tensor of two anti-degradable channels is still anti-degradable, so I can't use them together just by themselves to get a non-zero capacity. So I'll give you one example. Imagine that U maps into the symmetric or the anti-symmetric subspace of B and E. So these guys are isomorphic in some sense. And an example of one of those would be what I'll call a 50% erasure channel. So here, there's some input state. Half the time, the receiver gets it. And the other half of the time, the receiver doesn't get it. It gets sent to the environment, and the receiver knows it. So this state erase is something that's orthogonal to all the degrees of freedom in the state row right here. And So I'll call these channels symmetric channels. And it turns out that these symmetric channels, they're also degradable, right? So I mentioned degradable before. And that just means that this map goes the other way by symmetry. I mean, this is really just the identity channel for these symmetric channels. So again, I mentioned before that when you have a degradable channel, we completely understand the quantum capacity. So we actually also understand it for degradable or anti-degradable. And that's really it, Robin.
Degradable channels, the single letter coherent information is the capacity. Right? Mm-hmm. But do we also have a way of calculating that without doing a numerical optimization necessarily?
Well, you maximize the coherent information, but it also turns out that's a convex problem for degradable channels.
Okay.
So it's easy to do. So this second class of channels that we use for this example, something which we're calling them Horodetsky channels in honor of the Horodetsky family who discovered this condition. But they're also known as entanglement binding channels or PPT channels because they can only produce joint states between the sender and the receiver that satisfy the positive partial transpose condition. So what that means is that if I write out any bipartite state that you can create from one of these channels in a block matrix form like this, where the blocks correspond to, say, you know, to B, and or each one of these blocks is a state of B, and then the blocks are labeled by a basis for A, that if I take just the transpose of each one of these blocks, that the matrix that I get is positive semi-definite. So any matrix that satisfies this is a PPT, positive partial transpose state. And it turns out that by local operations and classical communication between, you know, by these guys talking to each other over the phone and doing local quantum operations, that they could never take a state with positive partial transpose and produce a negative eigenvalue for this. But that means that the quantum capacity has to be zero. That's because any entangled pure state has a partial transpose that's not positive. This is actually really easy to show. So once again, we find that these channels are stable under the tensor product. So again, I could never combine two such channels together and get a non-zero capacity. But as it turns out, and this is really the critical point, is that some of these channels allow you to send private classical communication or private classical information through them. And it's really those types of channels that are going to be useful for what we want to do. So given a channel here from A to B, and we've got the environment system E here, I can define the private capacity of this channel as the number of bits that I can reliably send through the channel while requiring that essentially that the environment state is going to be independent of whatever message that I send. So this is sort of a constrained classical capacity in a way. And so there's a formula, which is another one of these regularized infinite formulas, but it has this lower bound here. So this is a maximum over input ensembles of density matrices of the difference between the mutual information between the symbol X, which is a classical variable, and the output B, difference between that and the mutual information between X and the environment. Right? So you can think of this second term as like a penalty that you pay by having to make sure that the environment is sufficiently confused about all the different messages you might send. And so the ultimate capacity, the best we have, is again, is a formal expression that says you regularize this at this ugly limit. But again, that's not deep. It just says we don't understand it. So, but the key thing here is that there exist Hardesty channels that are private, meaning that so they have a zero capacity because of their nature, but they have a non-zero private capacity. And this was shown by the Hardetskys and Oppenheim. And there's also a simple four-dimensional example that was found by the Hardetskys and Pankowski shortly after. But and really, I should say that this is the quantity that they showed is positive for those channels. So it turns out that there's a close relationship between this private information here and the coherent information. And that's kind of at the heart of how this counterexample works. And the idea is that so this coherent information for some input state rho, how much time do I have? Okay. So the coherent information for some input state rho A, which is the difference between entropy of the output and the environment, just to remind you, you can write this as a difference of mutual informations between, say, some random variable X and B, and that between X and E. And the only difference is that up here, this quantity here has mixed state ensembles at the input. But if I fix any pure state ensemble that averages to rho A, it's actually pretty easy to show this. And it essentially comes from the fact that both sides of a pure state have the same entropy, right? So for each one of these rho sub x a's that I send through the channel here, the entropy at B and the entropy at E are going to be the same. And what I can do is I can write this quantity here as the entropy of B minus the average entropy of B overall that inputs X, right? And this one here is going to be entropy of E minus the average entropy of E over all these states X. But I've got a minus here too. So those two averages cancel. And that's how I get this. But that only works if I have pure states. And the fact that this maximization here is over a larger set than this maximization here, or the one inherent in defining the Q1, or the coherent information bound, is what lets this guy become larger. So what we're going to do is we're going to take one of these private Horodetsky channels. We'll take some ensemble that achieves a non-zero private information. We'll purify that ensemble, and we'll send the other half through a 50% erasure channel. That's going to be how it's done. And I'll do that on the next slide. So here's the counterexample. And I'll write this as somewhat of a formal theorem. So just given some channel n, let's let an input distribution p of x be given, and some ensemble on input states, rho a sub x. And let's let E be a 50% erasure channel that's big enough in the following sense. So the input dimension is just the sum of the ranks of the states in this ensemble here. Okay? Then the single letter coherent information is lower bounded by a half of the difference between these two mutual informations here that I use to define the private capacity. So I'll prove this on the next slide. But let me just add that there exists a private Horodetsky channel, I said this earlier actually, with a four-dimensional input. But here's the ensemble that you need. Okay, it takes in two qubits. The first qubit you just put in zero or a one, orthogonal states, and the second qubit is just maximally mixed. And this is the ensemble that if I stick in over here, I get a bound of 0.02. So this is sort of a modest bound, but others have been at work finding other examples of channels like this. But this is the simplest one. It's in the smallest dimension that we know of. And so if you take this channel and you put it together with a four-dimensional erasure channel, or one with a 4D input, that this gives me a quantum capacity of at least 1 over 100. And presumably, you could do better. So how do I prove this? So what we do is, so imagine the setup. Here's the channel, the Horodetsky channel. Here's the erasure channel, 50% erasure channel. And I'm going to define a state here, which is a purification of the ensemble that I'm starting with, right? So here's this classical system X, which holds the identity of the states in the ensemble. And here, these are purifications of the individual states in the ensemble. And I pick these, so again, I picked C to be big enough so that basically each of these purifications goes into an orthogonal subspace of C. So somebody measuring C could also learn everything that's in this variable X. And that's sort of a technical condition. But it's needed so that if I trace out over C, I get this state here, which is kind of a way of writing classical and quantum variables in one setting. Right? So it's a block diagonal density matrix whose blocks are proportional to the states in the ensemble. And the proportionality constant is given by their probabilities. So we know that this quantum capacity, this single letter bound, is given by the difference between the output entropies and the environment entropies. So here, B and D are the respective outputs of these two channels, and E and F are the respective environments. Okay, so H of BD minus H of EF. So what we'll do is we're gonna write this here in terms of entropies on the state that you would get before you applied the erasure channel. But after you apply this Horodetsky channel, okay? So here we start off with the state on XAC over here, and then I'll transfer this stuff over here. So I have XBE, but I'll keep C over here. And we do that in two steps. First, imagine that C got erased, okay, which happens half the time because it's a 50% erasure channel. And if I write out these entropies, I get this. Okay, so in other words, D gets nothing. It gets a pure state, doesn't contribute to the entropy, and F gets C. So I get this. And then the other half the time, B gets C and E gets nothing. Right? So D becomes C. But then, on this state here, on these four systems, rho X, B, E, C, what happens is if I take, you know, the entropy of half of the state equals the entropy of the other half of the state, right? So entropy of EC equals entropy of XB. And same here. So I can just swap those guys. But then it's easy to show by adding entropy of X to this part and subtracting it from this part that I get this difference in mutual energy. And that's how you prove the theorem. So wrapping up, there's some other implications that we can get from this result. One is that we can show that the quantum capacity is not even convex, which is kind of weird, because Shannon's capacity, classical channel, is convex. And the coherent information is convex, too. And here's how we give a counterexample for that. I mean, it's a slight counterexample, but we basically take this Hardesty channel and this erasure channel, say, from the previous example I gave. And you ensure that the receiver knows which one happened. So we're able to prove that for a fairly small p, probably can get larger, actually, that you can get a non-zero capacity for this channel, even though the when p is 0 or 1, the capacity is 0. So strangely enough, the night before we got this result, I was trying to prove that q was convex, and I was failing. Now I know why. But so it also shows that there's still some hope for channels which have Q equal to zero. So you shouldn't necessarily write off a noise model just because you seem to strongly suspect that Q is zero, even if like a single letter bound on it is zero. So for instance, this depolarizing channel, it just shows you how little we know. I showed you earlier that the best bounds we have on the maximum tolerable depolarizing probability are way off of each other. And maybe we should be a little more optimistic than pessimistic when it comes to quantum error correction. But just let me close with some questions that come about from this work. Well, kind of one of the more lofty questions is, how do I price quantum bandwidth? Or to put it another way, what is it that characterizes the information conveying properties of a channel? Because it's not the quantum capacity. I mean, it tells us something about it, but it's clearly not the whole story. Because zero is not zero, basically. I mean, a zero capacity means that there's something that's getting through, but maybe I'm being too harsh in how I'm judging the usefulness of a channel, because it can be useful in different contexts. So, but these are probably too hard to attack directly. I mean, you would probably solve these by accident, is what I would think. So maybe some more realistic things to try to do. One would be to maybe try to characterize the capacity zero channels, or find new classes of them at least. And are there more classes such that if I use them together in different ways, maybe there's triples that can activate each other, but with one removed, they can't. And maybe even more concrete of a thing to do, so I've got some ideas about it, is can we somehow characterize the boundary of this set of anti-degradable channels? So I mentioned that this is a convex set, and beyond it being convex, not much is really known about it. And for that matter, I mean, also finding more examples of channels with positive or large private capacities and zero quantum capacities, like these Hardesty channels. Are there smaller dimensional examples? Is there one in three? You can show there's not one in two. And how big can the discrepancy be? So Smith and Smolin have actually shown that I think they can get all the way up to a quarter of the input dimension or so, or the log of the input dimension. So how much better can we do? So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Questions?
So does this mean that we can use, if we have enough zero capacity channels, we can send information perfectly? Or
if you have enough of the right kind, yeah. Or we send it arbitrarily well, I should say.
Right.
Yeah. But you would need just, you would need both.
You need pairs of the variables.
So can you use similar ideas to say stuff about QKD? So I have kind of two opposite questions. The one would be, is there a similar result for private capacities? You have two channels with zero private capacity, but together they have non-zero. And
I'd like to know, but I don't know.
Okay,
I don't know the answer to that.
We don't know.
Okay. It could happen.
And the other side of the question then is, I mean, can this say something about QKD security conditions, like Eve? The eavesdropper has, you know, some, the scheme is secure if Eve has no information, really no information. But maybe she has some other kind of quantum information that doesn't not in itself tell her anything about the key, but together with the channel might, maybe that's the same question as the first one.
I mean, the difference might be that you might have to have the sender actively trying to give Eve as much information as possible. Because I feel like you can make the same argument about this. We'll say, well, I've got two channels together, therefore the environment could potentially have more power. But I think you would have to. I think you'd have to make some effort. But I don't really know.
Yes.
If there are no more questions, let's thank John.